So the series, as Ben said, is from anguish to awe. We're tracking Habakkuk's transition in this book of his, the prophecy that he was given to write down, the burden that he was given to write down, tracking his transition from anguish at just the devastating state of God's people, Israel, back in the 7th century BC, just before, at the end of that century, the Babylonian attack to take God's people, God's rebellious people, into exile. So in chapter 1, Habakkuk has expressed his anguish to God in prayer, basically saying, why aren't you hearing my prayers? Why is our nation in such a state? Why is it that your law, your holy law, isn't being adhered to? What's going on? Are you not aware? Are you not listening? Can you not see? And then the Lord responds, and it's basically like, well, I can see, and here's what I'm going to do about it. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to raise up this terrible nation, the Chaldean nation, otherwise known as Babylon, and they are going to come in and totally ransack Judah, Israel. Now, that's not exactly the answer that Habakkuk was looking for, hoping for. So he issues another complaint in chapter 1, as we heard last week. His second complaint is basically, how could you, Lord? How could you? Yeah, we're bad enough, I get that. But your answer to raise up an even worse nation than us and to massacre us through them, how could you? What kind of justice is that, where you use a deeper injustice to administer justice on your people, your wayward people? What's going on? What gives? So when the humanist says, for example, I'll just read you a quote just here. He says, the old philosopher's challenge to religion is as true today as it ever was. Is there an example of a good deed done or an ethical proposition advanced by a religious person that could not be done or advanced by a non-religious person? He's basically saying, you religious people, you like to do good deeds. Well, the non-religious person can match you deed for deed. Is it not so? But can you think of an example of a harm done by religion or a religious person that could only have been done in the name of that religion? There are many, he says. Good people do good, and bad people do harm. But for good people to do harm takes religion. That's what Andrew Copson, the chief executive of the British Humanist Association, said in Prospect magazine back in February 2016. It sounds good. It's a powerful paragraph. But then I picked up a book at home. One of my children was reading it, and it's called If I Were God, I'd End All the Pain. And it's by a guy, an Australian, called John Dixon. It's a great book. I pick it up for yourselves and your children. If I were God, I'd end all the pain. And in that book, John Dixon recounts something sad that happened in his life. He had a good friend, Charles, and he and Charles, they went to school together, and they made all sorts of plans together, their kind of bucket list together. And Charles's big plan was to be an Olympic runner. And so Charles would train. And at one point, he did some traveling. Charles went off traveling before uni or before launching out on his career. and he went to Kenya. And actually, when he was in Kenya, he got a job, and when he was in Kenya, also, he fell in love. And he came back to Australia one time to just feed back, catch up, chew the cud with his mate John, and talked about his joy in finding this woman, the love of his life, who he had intentions to marry. Well, a week or so after that conversation took place, he was back in Nairobi, dead. And it seems that the siblings of the love of his life took issue with the idea that this white man should have their sister for a wife. Now, we find it quite easy to look at that and say, those bad people, they did harm, right? Bad people do harm. But go up to those people and say, why did you do it? And they'll say, well, he had no right. He had no right to take our sister. We did the right thing. Isn't that how it works in the world and in our hearts? Someone can say, that's a bad thing. And you say, well, hey, no, not as far as I'm concerned. As far as I'm concerned, I'm doing the right thing. You find it on the roads, don't you? Someone crashes into you head on. They're looking out the back window. They crash into you head on. Comes down to the issue of, well, the circumstances of the incident with the insurers. And what happens? The guy in the other vehicle was saying, it was their fault, it wasn't my fault. So we all see ourselves, really, as being good people. But here's the thing. Good is only in inverted commas. As we well know. And good people do harm. And religious people do not have a monopoly on doing harm by any stretch of the imagination. We have this phrase, it's okay as long as you're not hurting anyone else. But the thing is, anything that we get passionate about is liable to get us or someone else hurt. It's our condition. Now Habakkuk, you could say, has every reason. He's heard that there's going to be this Chaldean or Babylonian offensive against his people. You might say he has every reason to go out on a death-bent bender in anti-Babylonian fury. These guys are about to do serious, untold damage to my people. Well, I'm going to hit them back first. I'm going to get an army together and we're going to go on an anti-Babylonian riot, a death spree. Jihadis, eat your hearts out. The Babylonian offensive struck in 605 BC initially. And the words we read are set just before all of that kicked off. So how about that? How about Habakkuk hits the Babylonians back before they hit his people? And he could make like us and justify it. I mean, he clearly doesn't like God's ideas for justice. And Babylon's justice goes out from his own self. Remember, chapter 1, verse 4, Habakkuk's complaint is, your law, Lord, seems to be paralyzed. It's not working. It's not doing what it's supposed to do. God's law seems paralyzed. Whereas in chapter 1, verse 7, the Babylonians' justice and dignity go forth from themselves. They have their own set of rules that they abide by that suits them just fine, and it's living and active. And doing a lot of damage internationally. So why not, Habakkuk? Dredge up some justice of your own. Pick up your spear, your knife, your gun. Vigilante spiritual warfare. Ah, jump out of it, you do that, you come out. I met a kid last week. He said to me he'd done some bad stuff. And I said, do you feel guilty about that? Like God should punish you? No. Why not? They shouldn't have come for me. If they hadn't come for me, if they hadn't come around my way, I wouldn't have had to do what I did. It's their fault, not mine. I get that. But what do we find Habakkuk doing in verse 1 of chapter 2? He stands. In the same place as you might stand if you were waiting to see if the enemy army were going to attack. I will take my stand at my watch post and station myself on the tower. Is he waiting for the enemy onslaught? No, not in the immediate term. He's waiting for God, to hear back from God. I will take my stand at my watchpost and station myself on the tower and look out to see what he will say to me and what I will answer concerning my complaint. Is he taking matters into his own hands? Is he starting another religious war? God answers. Verse 2, if you just look there. Write the vision. Make it plain on tablets so he may run who reads it. For still the vision awaits its appointed time. It hastens to the end. It will not lie. Basically, God says to Habakkuk, grab your notebook and your pen and write something down that's true. Write down what I told you about the callous killer Chaldeans. And now you stand right there and I'll continue to unfold truth for you to write down. You wait. It will all come to pass, terrible as it may be. Very soon now. I mean, this may be happening, this conversation may be happening actually in 605 BC itself, the very year of the Babylonian attack. It's imminent. Maybe just a few months away. If it seems slow, God goes on to say at the end of verse 3, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay. Again, God knows that the approaching enemy is not characterized by anything approaching humility or mercy. His whole being, verse 4, is puffed up with destructive pride. But how do you combat the pain that feels like doom? The darkness dressed in death. You don't take out your sword and cut its ear off. You just trust. You just trust. And that's really the invitation from God to us today. Will you just trust? Trust. The strength God prescribes sounds perhaps a little pathetic. No taekwondo, no muay thai, no special weapons and tactics. Just trust. Perhaps verse 5, you don't like the idea of just trust. So you think maybe just drink. Obey your thirst. Drown your sorrows and your fears. No, that's really not going to help. Verse 5, wine is a traitor. What's wine got to do with it anyway? Well, I think just like chapter 1 had a double edge, if you will, what with Israel's injustice on the one hand, and then the Babylonian offensive to deal with that injustice on the other. In chapter 2, there's a double edge too. We find out about the need to just trust. In the face of the pain and the darkness coming from out there, the Babylonian attack that is imminent, but also the potential for pain and sorrow coming from in here because of our perhaps wrong response, our distrustful response to what God prescribes and administers. The enemy raised up against us from out there is faced with faith. But there's an equally savage enemy in here. And when the storm comes, will you drown your sorrows in wine? Will you comfort eat your way through despair? Will you dope yourself through? Will you make like a bear and hibernate? Or will you just trust? Death's appetite is insatiable. There's room for all of us in the grave. But if we just trust death's defeat in Christ's resurrection victory, we won't taste death. Death will have lost its sting forever. Sin and death gather all nations and collect all peoples as though they belonged to them. Look at verse 5. Wine is a traitor, an arrogant man who is never at rest. His greed is as wide as Sheol. That's the place of the dead. Like death, he never has enough. He gathers for himself all nations and collects as his own all peoples. So there's a double edge. There's the Babylonian imminent attack, but there's also this spiritual kind of Sheol death edge. And we need to be warned about that, and we need to respond to the attack without and within with faith. So verse 4, the righteous shall live by his faith. The Apostle Paul takes up that phrase in chapter 1 of his letter to the Romans, and it crops up in various places in the New Testament. The righteous shall live by his faith. And it's not a sort of detached faith in something that happened 2,000 years ago and appears to be less and less relevant to life today. It's something that you actually need to lean on for hope and security and safety and sanity and peace today. Will you just trust? Jesus said, I, when I'm lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself. We see death and Babylon gathering all to themselves. He gathers for himself all nations and collects as his own, all peoples. Yeah, but when I'm lifted up from the earth, says Jesus, will draw all people to myself. Just trust. You've got Babylon out there, the world out there, the devil out there, hostile enemies. Unstoppable? Almost. And you've got wine and the grave drawing you in here. Sin and death opening wide their mouth. So you implode in sin's snare. Inevitable? No. Jesus said, I, when I'm lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself. Just trust. Something about our confession of faith is that it's public. One of the ways we just trust is by publicly declaring our faith in the office, in the neighborhood, in the home, and of course, at church. Perhaps today you are aware, as I am, of so many ways in which you just don't trust or just won't trust. And yet the righteous in a sin and war-torn world, against which the wrath of God is being revealed, as Paul says in Romans 1 verse 18, the righteous shall live by their faith. In a moment, I want to give us the opportunity to reflect, hear a piece of music, pray, and openly confess a commitment to renewal in our confession of faith, simply by standing. And for as many who want to and feel, whether you've been a Christian for years or whether you've maybe today is the day that you become a Christian, whichever you are, I want to invite you to just simply at the end of our time, just to stand, and for as many as who stand, we'll just pray for you. Not as intermediaries between you and God. Christ occupies that spot, the great high priest. But as intercessors, as we're all called to be for one another. But before we do that, just take a look at verses 6 to 20 of our passage for some added perspective. Remember that quote at the start about good people doing good and bad people doing harm? And then it is said that for good people to do harm takes religion. It's well put. The only problem is that religion doesn't make one good. The only righteousness is achieved by faith in the one who is righteous, the one who is good, God himself. Not achieved by religious fervor or violence. So yes, verses 6 to 8, it's woe. Woe one of five. There are five woes in these verses. The first of which is against the corrupt rich. Bad people doing harm. In verses 9 to 11, it's woe number two of five. To those who seek security and comfort while those outside get massacred. You can imagine that, can't you? Babylon comes attacking to feather its own nest. Never mind the trail of carnage left behind. It's a huge, man-made, self-centered security system. Just thinking of self while others suffer. The rap artist Propaganda has a track called Cynical. And he talks about Americans. Easy to talk about Americans whilst we're over here. arguing over bathrooms or marching for their political views whilst failing to express compassion for refugees who could easily stay in their homes and enjoy their immaculate bathrooms. I mean, the same goes for us. Challenging words. It's wicked. And many of us would say we are good people. We're the good guys, right? We're not the guys in the Middle East or the guys, you know. God says, woe to that. And the only thing that's going to change that is faith. Just trust. Verses 12 to 13. Woe number three. It's not just individual households, but it's whole towns who can do the we're building a safe haven, a polite civilization. Only trouble is we're building it on you guys over there, the child labor that we're exploiting you for. Woe to that, says God. Woe to him who builds a town with blood and founds a city on iniquity. Behold, it is not from the Lord of hosts that peoples labor merely for fire, and nations weary themselves for nothing. There's actually something of God in this. That he's saying, well, he set it up that insofar as we will not just trust, we will weary ourselves, laboring for gain, comfort, security, and ease. But it's going to be for nothing. And we will do it at the expense of one another. And God is showing us something. He's saying the only way that lasting peace and comfort and security are going to be found is when I take the initiative to fill this whole earth with my glory as the waters cover the sea. And that's what I'm doing. But will you not take stock, realize the state of affairs, that in every century, every decade, there's war-torn violence and hurt, one man against another, be he religious or not, doing harm. Good people doing harm. Bad people doing harm. We need to just trust. Surrender ourselves to God. Verses 15 to 17, it's the drunkards headed for shame in woe number 4 of 5. But wait, because it's not alcohol. It's not alcohol that's being consumed, if you look at those verses there. It's wrath and fury. An empire that pours its wrath out on others, forcing them to drink, will itself in turn drink from the cup of God's wrath. And now look at verses 18 to 19. This woe, 5 of 5, is for the world's religions. It said, unlike the humanist Andrew Copson, God doesn't call them good. The gods of the nations. Humanism, by the way, is also a religion. Atheism is a religion. It's a faith position. Humanists just don't believe in God. They believe in humanity. Just a different expression of belief. And it's a faith position that causes harm. Why? Aren't humanists good? Isn't it good to believe in humanity? Don't they believe in the good of man and want to head away from all the injustices of the first 4 woes that we just heard? Well, it's wicked because it's not the answer. And certainly militating against faith in the true and living God who raised up the forces that cause our pain in the first place is not the answer. God is not answerable to humanists. Humanists and all of us are answerable to God. God verse 20. God is in his holy temple. And it's time humanity realized this and started to seek him through Jesus in the Spirit. The same Spirit who inspired these five woes. Just trust. You know, more and more people are on their census forms filling out, ticking the box on the vis-a-vis religious affiliation. They're ticking the box labeled none. The nuns are growing exponentially, particularly among the young. And what some research from the British Academy says is that the faith of the parents is less sticky than the atheism and secularism of those parents. And yet, even though we progressively reject religion, the religious leader we most respect is the Dalai Lama. You can have your religion, says society, but just don't you preach at me. And don't tell me what to do. I will make up my own mind in my own time. And I'll pick and mix whatever takes my fancy, whenever it takes my fancy, in my own time. Well, listen, accept it or not, in God's own time, all the nations of the world will be judged. We've been praying for peace. That peace will come via, ultimately, the one who comes again to judge the living and the dead, the Prince of Peace. And verse 14, the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. If it's a contest between your view and God's view, you lose. If it's a contest between your worldview and God's worldview, or your justice and God's justice, you lose. Regardless of what the stats and the census results indicate, you lose, not God, and not those who patiently, quietly trust and wait. So join us, as it were, on the watchpost. Watch and pray to the one whose word never fails, the one who will accomplish his purpose to fill this earth with his glory, even as the waters cover the sea. It's peaceful, and it's not even a protest. It's just a holy, and by holy I mean a different or unique. It's a holy trust in the one who is in his holy temple. It's a quiet confidence that the earth will be silenced before him. Let's be quiet now. We'll have a moment of quiet. I'm going to play some music. Now, the music serves a double purpose. First of all, it's the song that we're going to sing at the end, and I think a number of you will be unfamiliar with it, so it serves the purpose of familiarizing yourselves with the words and the melody. But also, it will serve the purpose of just giving us a bit of time to reflect. I hope the music doesn't drive you mad and stop you from reflecting. That's not the intention. And then at the end, I'm just going to invite you, if you feel moved, not so much by me, but as by God this morning, to just stand and renew and confess your faith, as it were, even quietly, just by standing. Then feel free to do so as the music ends, and I'll pray for you. Just some quiet.